This is Embodied on the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. For hundreds of years, people seeking to follow the standards of femininity have plucked, shaved, lasered, and ripped away unwanted body hair. But what made it become unwanted in the first place? Relationships to body hair are as varied as the bodies they inhabit. And much of the stress and pressure dates back to the formation of a beauty standard focused on whiteness and hairlessness. Sharon Dhaliwal is the founder and editor-in-chief of Burnt Roti magazine. She has written about her experiences as an Indian woman coming to terms with her body hair. Sharon, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. Also with us is Rebecca Herzig. She's a professor of gender and sexuality studies at Bates College, also the author of Plucked, A History of Hair Removal. Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sharon, I want to start with you and your early experiences of your body hair. Tell me when you first really became aware of it.
Well, I was thinking about this the other day. I think I became really aware of my body hair really at a really young age. There's no exact age I can remember it happening, but I think I was aware of my facial hair first, because my body hair I tend to hide quite easily with trousers or long sleeves, and as a child you don't really recognize that or think about that, but with facial hair it's not something I could have really covered. So I think that's when I first recognized it, and it was definitely probably before I was even 10 that I recognized that I had excessive hair, and that it wasn't, like, it was considered, I guess, ugly in a sense.
What made you feel like it was considered ugly? Because I feel like there's so much conversation about armpit and leg hair when we're growing up, mm-hmm. you know, and being aware of when people start shaving, but so much less so around chin hair or upper lip hair or any kind of facial hair.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think what it is there's a standard of beauty that we feel like we have to adhere to as, like, especially young women. And that standard is a completely hairless body. It's very much just like a Barbie doll in many senses. You have to be completely clean, as it was called when I was young. And anything that was other to that would, I guess, be described as ugly. So any kind of, like, facial or arm hair or belly hair or anything would be considered ugly. And in my Indian culture, it was considered unclean in a sense that dark hair on skin would also adhere to those kind of conversations around colorism, because as your hair was dark, your skin would look darker. So there was this kind of connection between beauty and colorism as well within that kind of conversation that I didn't recognize until I was a lot older.
Rebecca, how did body hair removal become linked to cleanliness? Because I think this is an idea we internalize at such a young age. You know, once you start shaving or removing your hair, you start to have these kind of visceral reactions of disgust to your own body hair, which, thinking about it abstractly, feels really absurd. So how does this begin?
I think Sharon's actually already pointed the way there, because it wasn't just that hair was linked to ideas about beauty or ugliness, but also around cleanliness and dirt and around racial hierarchy and racial supremacy. And those things, what I found in my research, sort of got flipped on their head in the 19th century. In the first few centuries, really, of European colonization of the Americas, the idea was that hairlessness, which the European colonizers saw as more commonly associated with indigenous peoples, the smooth skin, hairless skin, they saw that as quote-unquote deficient, like racially deficient, meaning not as civilized as the European standard that they were accustomed to. But also then, because it was seen as racially subordinate, they also kind of coded it in all these other ways as perhaps strange or even disgusting or animal-like in that way. The indigenous people, so far as we know, had very different ideas about European standards and norms, but that sort of held the case until well into the 19th century, when dominant white culture started switching it into the kind of norms that we're familiar with now, that smooth, hairless skin is seen as more desirable, as more beautiful, as more hygienic, as more normal in that way. And any of us who might deviate from it are kind of stigmatized or shamed or pressured to do something about it.
Yeah, I mean, in so many of the conversations that we've had on this Embodied series, this is reminding me of our conversation about diet culture and really looking at how science comes into the picture as a way to kind of reinforce and normalize and be a tool for a particular set of people to reinforce certain standards. So talk to me about how these early observations then became kind of ingrained in the science that really started happening in the 19th century.
It's a key part of this story, and that was going on even before science, as we tend to think of it, became professionalized and institutionalized in ways that we associate with sort of, the modern condition. Even when they were just sort of armchair observationalists and naturalists who would write, you know, little stories about what they saw or collect specimens for their home collections, that sort of thing. So in the first few centuries of contact, it was mostly that sort of natural observation and inquiry, but science hadn't really kind of moved into universities, into research facilities, into professional journals and standards of practice and that sort of thing. Even in the beginning, naturalists and natural philosophers were obsessed with differences between people based on body hair. I mean, any of the early naturalists you could think of, Linnaeus, Buffon, even Thomas Jefferson, who liked to do his own ethnological observations, they all wrote about body hair and racial differences, racial variations in body hair. But as science moved into kind of greater and greater authority and clout, certainly body hair moved right along with it, and there became whole fields, dermatology being one, that specialized in kind of standardizing what normal or excessive amounts of hair were and what appropriate treatments for so-called excessive hair should be. And that took off starting in kind of the late 19th century and really gaining speed and steam in the early 20th century.
And Darwin played a big part in this of really kind of institutionalizing very particular ideas about what's normal and what's not normal in terms of the amount of body hair. And we can see those threads all the way through to today. I want to play a quick clip here. And this is from Christy DeGary. She's a writer and photographer. And she is talking about the body hair conversations she is having with her daughter. Let's listen.
With my daughter, we were actually thrown into conversations really early because she developed body hair at a really young age. And also, like me, she has very dark hair. So she got a lot of comments from her peers. And I know a lot of people didn't agree with this decision. When she was much younger, so like 8, 9, 10, 11, I didn't actually allow her to shave. I certainly don't think that you shouldn't shave. I shave. I have zero problem with body hair removal. I just wanted her to have some time and hopefully provide her with some like supportive space to consider that having body hair is also a legitimate choice, because I think as a female, it often feels like it's not. You know, if your child was being bullied because their peers perceived them as too big, you probably wouldn't encourage them to lose weight.
That's Christy DeGary, a writer and photographer in Scotland. I'm here with Rebecca Herzig, the author of Plucked, A History of Hair Removal, and Sharon Dhaliwal, the founder and editor-in-chief of Burnt Roti magazine. So it's so interesting to see how those historical threads, you know, tie all the way through to today. Darwin in 1871 saying, you know, there's an association between hairiness and primitivity, and then people today feeling the way that they feel about their own body hair. Sharon, I wonder for you, I mean, as your own relationship with your hair has evolved and you've seen this big body positivity movement in the past few years, it doesn't seem to me like body hair is as much a part of the conversation as body size. I wonder if that struck you and if you have any thoughts about that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. There's definitely, I guess, certain aspects of any kind of like positivity movement that can concentrate on one thing at a time, I think. I think it's our ability and our attention span as humans really that allows us to do that. But there is a lack of conversation around body hair because I think it really does affect women of color a lot more than white women. Mm. And I think that's a big reason why, because it is so racialized, as Rebecca was saying earlier. And so I think that's why the conversation hasn't progressed that far. And when you do see, I guess, representation of body hair in the media or in adverts, for example, of shaving creams and so on, it tends to be white women, and it tends to be like small blonde wisps of hair kind of, you know, represented, which most women of color that have excessive body hair don't really I don't know, can't really relate to it. You know, it seems like it seems like another step backwards more than anything, because there's no real representation there. There's no real discussion about body hair. And so I think that, yeah, one of the biggest reasons definitely is because I think it affects women of color more than white women. Even though there is, like, obviously, most definitely white women out there that do have excessive body hair too. I think statistically, when you look into the amount of women that are affected by it, it tends to be women of color.
All right, we're going to take a quick pause here and continue our conversation just ahead about what's considered excessive, how we come up with those determinations, and then the history of body hair removal. We'll deep dive a little bit more into that as we continue our conversation on Embodied. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is Embodied on The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Pressure about what you should and shouldn't do with your body hair started in the late 1800s. Scientific research associated standards for feminine beauty with a white hairless model. How are those standards still influencing the personal choices people make today about their bodies? My guests are Sharon Dhaliwal, the founder and editor-in-chief of Burnt Roti magazine, and Rebecca Herzig, a professor of gender and sexuality studies at Bates College and the author of Plucked, A History of Hair Removal. So, Rebecca, I want to start picking up on what Sharon said toward the end of that last segment about the idea of excessive and who has excessive body hair. And this brings us to this hirsutism, which is a medical condition that describes this hormonal imbalance and excessive hair growth. So tell me about the medicalization of excessive hair growth and how that came to be.
So it all started coming together as science was becoming sort of professionalized and institutionalized in the late 19th century. So the first medical classification for excessive hairiness was actually a disease called hypertrichosis, which still exists, and which is just like it sounds, excessive hypertrichosis hair. But the doctors who came up with the category and set about its standards were very explicit in just the way that Sharon's suggesting, and saying which people should be considered as falling under this category and which ones shouldn't. Men could be, people who they identified as men could be diagnosed with hypertrichosis as well. But a lot of their kind of discussions in medical journals and at medical conferences, you can see the publications of what they discussed in some old medical journals, were about where exactly the boundary lines are in kind of difficult to call cases. And they were pretty clear there that their attentions were primarily focused on people they identified as women, people they identified as white, and people they identified as young. And one of them was very explicit that that's because that's when they're marriageable and that's when we care most about what they look like. And they were incredibly frank about that. But you can find all kinds of old articles talking about what standards of hair growth were, both across genders and across perceived races and across age. You know, does it change with age? Does it start at puberty? When does this begin? And there were also quite a lot of studies in the late 19th century about whether then excessive hairiness in women across races might be associated with higher degrees of insanity, was the word they used, of mental health disorders. And so people started studying this in institutions for the mentally ill, as well as in just their ordinary practice as people came into their clinics or hospitals or practices seeking help. So, it was very much a part of the scientific discourse and connected to larger questions about normalcy and deviance.
And now, I mean, we have this scale today that's used that kind of scores you on 9 different body areas, but it's still really based on the bodies and the hair growth on white women, white cis women, which is not what the hair growth looks like in women of color and women of other communities. So I wonder, Sharon, for you, I mean, growing up with hair that you felt like was excessive, that made you uncomfortable, when did you start removing it and how did that begin for you?
So like the segment that you played earlier of that mum that was speaking, my mum didn't let me remove hair for a long time. when I was young, which actually affected my mental health quite negatively, because of the influence of young people around me and the way they would treat me. So I would do it secretly. There were times where I'd be up in my room, I'd remove hair and go downstairs and just kind of like, I guess, like announce that I no longer have a beard. And my mum would just be very shocked and quite upset that I did that. But I think I did start removing it in my early teens. But in I didn't know what I was doing. Like there were times I just shaved my upper lip, or like tried to shave parts of my eyebrows and completely ruined my eyebrows. And it was just like a panic. It was a panic, kind of a need to try and attain this beauty that I thought I needed to attain. And so I would panic remove hair. I remember when I used to like thread my whole face on a daily basis in the morning before leaving the house. So I'd have to wake up half an hour earlier than usual so that I would have to go through that process before I could leave the house. And it was just this massive part of my life, from such a young age until I guess I hit my 30s, and there were other ways. I mean, it was before my 30s. I discovered other ways of removing hair. But it was in my 30s that I guess my relationship with my hair changed quite a lot.
How did it change?
Well, I was talking about this to a friend the other day. I think it changed with when I came out. So I came out a few years ago as bisexual, and my relationships with people changed. And I noticed that a lot of my need to attain a certain beauty was to, and this was unconscious, I guess, to a certain extent, was to please a man. And then after I came out and I started discovering relationships with women and non-binary people, I found that I didn't have to do that. I didn't have to attain a beauty for those people. And that kind of shifted for me. That shifted the way I saw myself and the way I saw how I kind of fit in these kind of like communities, I guess. And so that kind of helped the way that I saw my own body in relationships. Like my partner right now, if I don't shave my legs, she'll just say, "Yeah, neither have I," and it's not a big deal. Whereas before in relationships with guys, if I haven't shaved my legs, they would say horrific things to me about it. And that really kind of changed my perspective on the way I saw myself.
Well, it has so much of it has to do with the gender binary and kind of our want to uphold it or position ourselves on one side or the other. And Rebecca, for you, I mean, looking throughout history at the history of how we have removed hair over the years, I mean, how much of it has to do with maintaining this gender binary?
A massive amount, but I would go farther to say that what I concluded based on what I found is that perceptions of body hair, treatments of body hair, those comments in the sense that Sharon was just describing, said between intimate partners or out in public or in workplaces, I think these are foundational how we constitute gender and race in the first place. You know, so it isn't just that maintaining hair is used to maintain gender binaries. The gender binary that was brought with Europeans and imposed in the Americans is maintained through this. You know, like it's the hair that becomes a vehicle for it. And one of the things that I found most fascinating about the whole subject is it's pretty easy for people to dismiss, oh, come on, you know, body hair, aren't there bigger issues right now? Isn't there a global pandemic? Isn't there an uprising against state violence against Black and Indigenous people? Of course, these things are true. But what is, I think, worth attending to is the way these seemingly little tiny trivial daily things, like what people do to their body hair or don't do their body hair, what they say to one another about their hair and the way it kinks or is straight and what have you, become part of these larger systems, these larger structures that then seem so difficult to shift. And I was really interested in how these sorts of daily, seemingly minute practices add up into large scale structures like gender binaries, like racial hierarchies, and the way that we can intervene in them in the way that Sharon is suggesting by, you know, intervening on these small daily ways as well.
Right. And it brings up this idea that, you know, that comes up so often in conversations about feminism, which is choice. You know, are we, if we're at a point where people can make the choice to remove or not to remove, are we, you know, have we reached liberation? But the question is, you know, what are the consequences of this choice for each person? Are they the same for a white woman as they are for a woman of color? No, as we've just described. So I wonder, I mean, are we, I guess for you, Sharon, maybe that's a question of, you know, looking at the consequences of choosing to not remove your hair. How do you reprogram yourself to kind of accept those, I guess, and reprogram others around you to accept those?
It's not an easy process. And to be completely honest, I still remove hair. I absolutely still remove hair. I've stopped removing the hair on my arms, which is, I do get comments on. I do. People do say it's excessive. There are men when I go out that put their arm next to mine and laugh. Mm. But that's the only hair I don't really remove, because I feel like that's my only kind of like, I guess, radicalization on this, not removing body hair. But I do it everywhere else. But to a certain extent, I think it's a really slow kind of unlearning. When I was younger, I would shave my legs. If there was a tiny bit that I missed, I would have a panic attack and run home. Mm. Whereas now I would just go, oh, well, missed a bit, you know, and it wouldn't affect me as much as it would have when I was younger. And that comes through time. That comes through the way that you accept yourself and your body and how you sit in this world. And it's taken me a long time, and it's through this kind of process of my mental health as well, and like dealing with a lot of aspects around me. And like Rebecca was saying, this is incredibly, like, not only is it racialized, it's to do with gender as well, but it's a structure within our society, and it's not like something that we have to fix within ourselves. It's something that is kind of put onto us, and it's kind of now ingrained in our society. So that unlearning isn't an easy process. It's not just you sitting there going, I should stop doing that. It's kind of realizing that it's out there, like that pressure is going to be out there, and that's probably not going to change in our lifetimes. But through that understanding, it's kind of slowly accepting yourself as a person.
I wish we had more time, but I have to say goodbye for now. My guests are Sharon Dhaliwal, the founder and editor-in-chief of Burnt Roti magazine, and Rebecca Herzig, a professor of gender and sexuality studies at Bates College and the author of Plucked, A History of Hair Removal. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you and your listeners.
In the broad strokes of art history, many traces of body hair have been painted out. After observing this lack of representation, visual artist Marilyn Minter set out to make beautiful images of a taboo subject, pubic hair. Those photos are now part of a collection titled Plush. Marilyn Minter is a faculty member at the School of Visual Arts in New York City, and she joins me now. Marilyn, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you.
So you just heard two people talk about their own varying relationships with body hair. I'm wondering for you how the conversation around body hair and feminism has evolved throughout your lifetime.
Well, I'm old enough to remember Playboy in the 70s. And personally, it's been, you know, I've always just groomed. But I noticed all through art history, I noticed that I had more pubic hair than anybody I'd ever seen in any paintings in art history. And that's really where I think the jump-off point was, that I saw it disappearing. And I had students that were talking about lasering. And I thought, God, I remember plucking my eyebrows out in the 60s, and they didn't grow back. And I thought, you know, there was just something about grooming, to the extent that, you know, you have to choose your lessons. You want to spend your life grooming yourself all day to go outside. It's just so time, you know, consuming. Or, you know, have some modicum of body acceptance. So my thought was, I'm going to make pictures of pubic hair that are so beautiful that people can put them in their living room. And I started with photographs, and then I ended up making a lot of paintings.
Well, tell us about these photographs and what you were doing. What were you trying to shoot? What was your intention behind this project?
Well, it's a long story in a way. I wasn't thinking about it that much at all. And then a curator, Neville Wakefield, a friend of mine, became another editor of Playboy. Like, Playboy got sold to another company, and he was going to remake it in the 60s version. And he said, and he came to me knowing that I had no trouble working with sexual imagery, and he said, do you have any ideas? And I said, well, I think I'm gonna make pictures of pubic hair that are, you know, I'd like to do all races and all colors. And he said, yeah, let's do it. And so Playboy actually paid for all the photos to get produced. And that meant asking models to grow out pubic hair. It literally took 8 months for some of them.
What was that experience like for them? And how did that show up in the shoot? I mean, did their relationship with their own body hair evolve by going through this process with you?
They were mostly models, paid a lot of money to do this. There weren't any Playboy models. They'd all been lasered. So they were off the street, you know, basically just normal people. And there is a pubic hair fetish or a hair fetish models, and they go from one place to another. And that was my redhead. There was a beautiful redhead, and then there was a fetish model that I've shot many times. She has body hair, really long hair, armpit hair, pubic hair, and so she was with the model for most of. But that's how I got introduced to all my models. And but here's what happened: I shot them, and Playboy was horrified by that. So they spent a lot of money, you know, on these shoots, but I had the pictures. So, and then a friend of mine, Richard Prince, the artist, who had a publishing house, and the people that ran that, Fabiola Alandro and Jane Harmon, they do this publishing of Richard Prince books and books that he likes, and he said, let's do a book called Plush, and that's what we did, and that's where I used all the images.
So you mentioned that they were horrified, which I guess brings me to the question about our response to images that of our pubic hair and how images can play a role in changing cultural ideas about beauty.
It's true.
Do you think they can? Yeah, tell me about that.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's so interesting. I mean, if you look through all of our history, you never see any pubic hair. You know, there's only a handful of paintings where there's pubic hair, and I know them all. And I think that's just remarkable. And I thought, well, what were they thinking in ancient times? You know, why did the statues have no pubic hair? Why is David, the statue of David, he has small genitals? Because they considered it vulgar at the time. I mean, I'm not an art historian, but I have read that much. And I thought, pubic hair is considered vulgar? And I thought, wow, you know, that's just, I'm a feminist. Body acceptance is part of right, we're trying to retrain myself, and you know, not you know, I start questioning immediately any knee-jerk reactions I have about body production. You know, the way we're supposed to groom ourselves. I do have knee-jerk reactions, and I have to question that immediately.
Well, we mentioned, I just want to ask you about what Sharon mentioned earlier about the consequences being different for women of color, and when we go beyond talking about, you know, armpit hair and leg hair and to types of hair that, you know, are much less feminized. Do you think that art can play a role in normalizing that too? And have you seen any?
Well, no. It doesn't exist. I think I'm the first artist that has, you know, basically ever made it a subject matter. I mean, that's pretty shocking, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Think about it. There's this famous story about, I don't know if it's true or not, but Ruskin, the art critic, got married and he thought his wife was malformed because she had pubic hair. And he couldn't have sex with her. He ran out of the room. He's like a famous art critic. You know, that kind of aestheticized, you know, wispy blonde hair, you know, you just don't see it anywhere. I mean, that's just amazing. You look at all of art history. And there's that famous painting, Courbet, The Origin of the World. And then I see a couple of Van Goghs with pubic hair and armpit hair. But, yeah, that's pretty much it. And maybe there's, like, fetish artists doing it right now that I don't know about. But I think body acceptance is such a healthy new development. It's just starting to happen. But like I said, I ended up making these 8x10 paintings of pubic hair, and I tried to make them so beautiful that you could put them in your living room.
Well, hopefully people can see your photographs and your paintings, and maybe it'll start changing a few more minds. My guest is Marilyn Minter, a visual artist and faculty member at the School of Visual Arts in New York. Thank you so much, Marilyn.
Thank you.